This episode of The Next Step is brought to you by Fremantle Press and the book Kintsugi by Marie O'Rourke. All her life, Marie O'Rourke has been a good girl, a perfectionist, using words to apply golden seams to an imperfect life in an attempt to make something beautiful out of things that are flawed or broken. A volatile father, the death of a sister far too young, a faltering marriage, the ghosts of lovers past. These are just some of the fragments that Marie puts together again in these essays that explore her closest relationships as a daughter, sister, mother, wife, and lover. With exquisite prose, Marie reflects on the beauty of brokenness and the ways in which time can transform our understanding of truth, forgiveness, and healing. These essays are a poignant reminder that some things cannot be fixed, but can still hold immense beauty and meaning. Whether you've experienced similar struggles or are seeking a deeper understanding of the human experience, Marie's collection will have you moved and inspired. How many of us feel our family life is not picture perfect? This book will resonate with those who are interested in exploring the human condition through universal themes of love and loss, forgiveness and redemption. Welcome to The Next Step. The next step is figuratively, but also literally in this case, what happens after the first time. It's about figuring out what to do next in life, specifically how to manage the push-pull between ambition and contentment. Like, what do you have to do to achieve the things you want, and how can you be happy if you achieve nothing? Sometimes I wonder, would I be better off spending my time setting goals and making lists or meditating? Perhaps I should do a vision board. How do people make money and grow successful multi-million dollar businesses? Like, what are the actual steps? And are ice baths the answer to everything? I'm Catherine Collette, and this is The Next Step. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. This episode, I speak to Bridget Delaney. Bridget Delaney is currently a political speech writer. She was a journalist for The Guardian and wrote popular weekly column, Bridget Delaney's Diary, which we talk a little bit about in this interview. She wrote that column for 8 years. It is so good, like unbelievably and consistently funny. It has very much stood the test of time. I'll link to the cheese story and the mansion story mentioned in this episode in show notes. Bridget also wrote Wellmania, the book the Netflix series is based on, but the main thing we talk about in this interview is stoicism, which is the focus of her most recent book, Reasons Not to Worry. I have wanted to speak to her about it for a long time. Bridget wrote an article about stoicism when COVID first started, and it felt like it offered a sort of solace I didn't see anywhere else. I am in no way a stoic professional, but the concepts I find very useful, particularly from a creative perspective. Hopefully you will too. Welcome, Bridget.
Thank you, Catherine, for having me. Great to be here.
There is so much that I want to talk to you about, but one thing in particular is the subject of your latest book. It's on stoicism. It's called Reasons Not to Worry. It is the best title, I have to say. I don't think anything could be more perfect for a book on stoicism, but how did the concept of stoicism come into your orbit?
So my publisher at the time, Kelly Fagan, actually suggested the book. I'd done a story on stoicism for The Guardian, and I was interested in stoicism. So I'd started doing some online courses and doing some reading, and I was discussing it with Kelly one night, and she said, I think there's a book in this. And I just wasn't engaged with the subject closely enough to think that I could do a book. And I was also intimidated by the academic nature of it, the fact that there are a lot of experts. There are people that have studied, you know, PhDs in kind of Hellenic philosophy. And who was I to write a book? But I think what Kelly saw was that it could be having a lay person write about it could make it more accessible to other lay people. So that was the kind of pitch. And we just took it from there.
It's funny that you say that, because I think in the book you cite at different points, you know, so-and-so modern day Stoic philosopher, which just seems like such a contradiction in terms in many ways.
It is. I guess it's you know, it's a constant. Stoicism was always meant to be updated for the times, and Seneca said as much. You know, he said the next generation will make something new of it, depending on the knowledge that they have. So it does sound like a contradiction, but it's actually quite, I guess, elastic enough to be modern, to be ancient, and that was part of the appeal of it.
Tell us about the tenets of Stoicism. What are they?
Well, they kind of build on each other. So the first one, which I think is the kind of main principle, is this thing called the control test, which is that you can only really control three things in your life, and that is your own character, your actions sometimes and reactions, and how you treat other people, and the rest is out of your control. So that's quite a liberating, edict, just because there's so much we think that we can control. And we spend a lot of time worrying and trying to control things, and a lot of energy trying to control things. But the Stoics and other ancient philosophers kind of had a very clear-eyed view of what was in our sphere and what wasn't. And the Stoics made that the kind of basis of their philosophy. So that's one that's called the control test. The second one is called preferred indifference, which is the things that you can't control. For example, you can't control your health. You can't control how money comes and goes in and out of your life. Like, you could make a bad investment, get robbed, lose your job. You can't control your reputation. You can't control what other people say about you. So it's natural to want a good reputation. It's natural to want to be healthy. It's natural to want to be wealthy or comfortable. But we should be indifferent to those things because they're outside our control. And that kind of leads to the third thing, which is this concept of ataraxia. So the Stoics really believed in having this baseline of tranquility. And from that, it was much harder to get upset. It was much harder to get agitated if you were constantly in this state of equilibrium, ataraxia, well-being. And you were more likely to have ataraxia if you weren't perturbed about losing your money or getting ill or being in an accident or having people say things behind your back. So the reason why you treat those things like money, health, and reputation indifferently is because you could lose them, and you don't want to lose your cool when you lose those things. And then the fourth main principle is the virtues, which is, you know, virtues is a very old-fashioned word, but it's well, what does a good character mean? You know, what is in our control in terms of how we develop our character? And the Stoics kind of isolated these four virtues. They are courage, wisdom, temperance, and justice. So they said all of those things are something that we should be striving for, and no matter what our station in life, you know, if we're sick, if we're healthy, if we're rich or poor, we can all achieve those four things. So, so they're the kind of main.
That's such a succinct overarching analysis. I can see why the appeal of a layperson explaining it is so appealing. I want to talk about each of those things essentially in turn. One is this idea of things that you can control. I was thinking about this in relation to being a writer or being a creative and putting your work into the world. It can be a hard thing. I think it's different from other types of jobs, largely because the very thing that you crave, which is an audience, can have a point of view on your work. They can review it, they can comment, they can buy it, they can not buy it.
That's if you're lucky to get an audience.
Well, that's right. That's right. That's true too. We worry a lot about the response of an audience, but really there's a step that's even worse than that, and that's having no audience.
Yeah, and that's the reality for a lot of writers. And I've certainly, you know, I've spent a long time writing books that sold, you know, very few copies. I've had books that I've written that have been rejected and never published. So I've traveled that road, and you know, in a way, Stoicism felt very like a good fit with writing because, I mean, the example they use, the ancient Stoics use, is a kind of lyre player, like a flautist or something, which is, you know, this person practices and practices, and they go out on the stage with their instrument and they perform a concert, but they can't, they can train to the best of their ability. They can prepare, but they can't necessarily control the conditions in the auditorium. They can't control how many people turn up. They can't control the reception of that crowd and whether or not the crowd's going to like it. So that example was used to kind of illustrate that, not that the audience doesn't matter, but you should do everything you can to make a good book or a good concert, but, you know, you should be quite indifferent to the reception because it's out of your control.
When you look back at the beginning of your career putting work into the world versus now under this sort of stoic point of view, has that made it easier?
Definitely. And I think it just gets easier as you get further into it as well, because I remember my first book, This Restless Life, it got a review in The Age, and it was like one of those tiny reviews, like a small review. And I was in an absolute rage about it. I thought, you know, the book deserved at least, you know,
a double page spread.
Maybe not a whole page, but more than a paragraph. So yes. I was really upset. I was, and I don't even think the Stoicism book got reviewed at all in the 9 papers. So, and that didn't bother me. But there was this, you know, I did have a sense of entitlement when I first started being published that I, you know, because I dreamt about it for so long. You know, it was a real, you know, it was very deep ambition. And so when it didn't happen the way I wanted it to, I was angry. Whereas now, and particularly with Stoicism, it would be I've written the best book I can write. I hope it finds an audience. Whether it does is out of my control. I can contribute to trying to get an audience by doing media, by going to bookstores and signing and doing events. But ultimately you can do all that and still not find an audience. And the main satisfaction should come from doing the work itself, not the reception that the work gets. And that's, I think, a really healthy thing for a writer. So I don't read Goodreads. I don't read, you know, I'm fairly indifferent to reviews or opinions. You know, I'm pleased if someone likes something, but it doesn't affect me particularly deeply whether people like something or not. And I think part of that is also having had a weekly column where I'm publishing a lot, so that, you know, I've got content out there a lot in the world and people have very strong opinions about it. And it's terrible if you listen to everyone, because then you become too self-conscious to write with freedom.
I do think that practice of putting something into the world regularly and getting some form of response to it is very useful just in developing the skill of caring less.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's taken, you know, that's taken decades. But, you know, there are, you know, obviously you should care what your editor says. And there's always a few readers who, you know, if they have a violent reaction to something, it's worth interrogating that. But if you've been writing for a relatively long time, like I tend to know if something's good or bad. Like I will know innately if it works or not on the page. So, yeah.
I want to talk about this term preferred indifferent. It sounds a bit like an oxymoron. How do you prefer something you're also indifferent about? And it also in some ways feels hard to come at the idea of health as something to be indifferent to. Has your thinking about preferred indifference changed as your Stoic practices has deepened?
Well, look, I haven't been put to the ultimate test, so I'm still healthy, and so are my friends and family. But, you know, that will be tested, and I'll have to see them whether or not I can be indifferent in the face of that. The Stoics formulated these ideas before modern medicine, before antibiotics. There was a huge, very high rate of child mortality. Marcus Aurelius, I think, lost like 7 children or some very large number. Seneca lost a son. Epictetus, one of the other major Roman Stoics, was a slave and lamed as a young child. So they didn't have, you know, they didn't have miracle cures. They didn't have the sort of technology we've got now. And so they had to develop a mindset that enabled them to endure whatever hardship they were experiencing at that time. So it was very much a coping mechanism. And I think it does work, you know, because what they were saying was that the main thing that is precious in your life is your own character. It's how you treat other people. And that can't be injured unless you consent to the injury. So your body is vulnerable to injury. It's vulnerable to illness. But your ability to be courageous in the face of hardship, to show justice and mercy to people that need it, to be moderate in your habits and to be wise and learn from, you know, your experiences, they're all things that we have control over. So, you know, you can't control if you get cancer or not. You can try. You can try to be healthy. You can't control if you're in an accident. You know, you can try and drive safely, but there'll always be other people on the road. So when those things happen, how are you going to cope with them? And I think, you know, you could do worse than look to the Stoics for coping mechanisms.
At the same time that I was reading your book, I was listening to Chris Voss's audiobook, Split the Difference. I don't know if you've read this. It's he's a former hostage negotiator for the FBI, and it's about negotiation in business and also in life. And part of the kind of the premise is that when academics started to study negotiation, their underlying assumption was that people were rational. And so they based all these practices and suggested ways of operating around that. But Chris Voss found in his work with people who'd taken hostages that emotion was the thing that played the bigger role. Obviously, that's not stating a philosophical position, but it felt like this really big contrast. One book acknowledging people are such emotional beings, he's sort of saying utilize emotion and empathy to steer them to make good choices, whereas Stoicism, at least on the surface, feels like it's about getting away from emotion. Is that a fair contrast?
It's an interesting contrast. I think rationality is the kind of prized sort of way of being in the Stoic world, using your rational thinking. The Stoics were a little bit suspicious of wild emotion, you know, high highs, low lows. They thought it led to bad decisions. And they also said that you can control your emotion. That is debatable. Where we know now, you know, neuroscience, you know, advances in psychology show that we have these deep submerged desires that flare up, you know, from our unconscious mind. We have patterns of behavior. We have ways of coping that were, you know, influenced by childhood. So rationality coexists with all these other things. So when I was you know, reading a lot of Stoicism, I had to kind of keep checking the emotion bit and saying, well, look, these guys, when they're writing about emotion, they weren't women, you know, like women have a completely different hormonal cycle. Men don't, you know, men have a different system. So the way they see the world and the way they see emotions is different. So there's a lot of things that the Stoics just couldn't incorporate into that philosophy because they didn't know. So in my book, I talk a bit about that. I test whether or not you really can control desire. You know, I think it's very hard, if not impossible. You can try. You can analyze it from different corners. I definitely think anger is, it's possible to control anger, and I think that's an important practice. But yeah, sorry, what was the original question?
No, that's all fascinating. My original question was just around this framing of Stoicism as being devoid of emotion in some ways. But it sounds like there's
The word devoid of emotion, I mean, because emotion, you know, emotion is part of being human and it's nature. So the Stoics were very much what is our nature? And our nature is that we are rational beings, but we are also emotional beings. And the kind of nub, I think, of Stoicism was to minimize suffering and to maximize joy. So they were very much into joy, and you know, they were very aware that life is short and you have to live it to the full. So how can you maximize those good emotions and minimize the bad emotions? So you know, that's they definitely weren't emotionless.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of good character or striving to have a good character. I mentioned in your bio that you wrote the column Bridget Delaney's Diary for was it 8 years, something like, which is an incredible feat to write for so long on a weekly column. I'm sure you're more aware of that than me. But it is the, like, even looking back, boy, have those articles stood the test of time. They are laugh out loud funny. I was reading some yesterday and actually crying with laughter. Wow. There was a particular one that you had written, which you may or may not recall, but it was about going to I'm just laughing thinking about it, going to an open for inspection for a mansion.
Oh, yeah. And I actually thought of that today.
You mentioned passingly, you ducked in. This is a big mansion, open for inspection. You duck in. The real estate agent sort of asks you something and you pretend that the house is too small for you. He then pursues you relentlessly. I was thinking about how there's this element of writing that is about the collection of experiences, and for that, chaos helps. Lying, you know, makes for funny articles. Like, we are so invested in that whole story, but from a Stoic perspective, it's maybe not a good character trait.
Absolutely.
So, like, is the joy that you get from Stoicism, is it a different type of joy? Is life still as funny if you're a practicing Stoic?
Yeah, the Stoics were very funny, actually. I think, look, it became, the chaos in my life made for some really funny columns, but it, you know, it didn't make living hard. You know, it was, you know, it was a, you know, it sort of calmed down now, and I don't know whether or not Stoicism has played a part in that, but, you know, I kind of would never be able to, I never know, like, I couldn't drive, I never knew where my keys were. Constantly, you know, having bizarre, you know, bizarre things were constantly happening to me.
The cheese story. Do you remember all the cheese? Like,
cheese. Oh, people gave me like 1,000 pieces of cheese and I had no fridge. Anyway, so these things were happening all the time, and it was great to write about it, but it also, you know, it can be hard to live in. And the Stoicism, I think, you know, to be Stoic, it's not that you can't have chaos in your life, but it's easier to be relaxed and tranquil when you don't. And, you know, it's, I think writers evolve, people evolve. And, you know, I'm happy that life isn't as chaotic at the moment. And partially that's, you know, having, you know, I've got a really grown up job at the moment, and I, you know, Stoicism's been a big part of my life. So, but you know, post politics, I will go back into that space of humorous writing, because I think it's good to, you know, it's good to swing between different types of lives. If you're a writer, it's good to, you know, completely immerse yourself in different experiences, because you have a different, you then have different sort of writing that comes out of that. So, yeah, I don't miss the cheese. I do miss the laughs, though. That was a fun column.
So funny. In relation to humour, as I said, you wrote that column for a long time. There is humour everywhere in your work. Is there a set of conditions, either for writing a column or writing more broadly, that you always know are going to be funny?
I think it's like if it's a story you will tell your friends at dinner or whatever, and you can tell it in a, like, something small that you can tell it in a way that really, like, gets the detail of the humor out, and they can either say, oh my God, that's so bizarre, or think it's hilarious. And so if it's something I would share with people and it's really funny, then it's probably a good column. It's also stuff that's relatable. So, you know, and often the things that happened to me that I wrote about are things that happen to everyone, but the details just pass so quickly that no one thinks to stop and turn it into a story. Like, I'm sure there are people that have been given, you know, like, after a party, the excess, and it's like this ridiculous amount of cheese, or, you know, I lived in the country for a while, you live in the country and some huge lizard makes their home behind your fridge and you can't get rid of the lizard. So it's all the sort of small moments that, if they're written in a certain way, become universal and they also become like really funny.
Are you catching these moments now? I mean, obviously you don't have the column anymore. Do you have a method for writing them down or recording them or hanging on
I
to them?
I keep a diary. I've always kept a diary. And, you know, I write a lot of, I mean, some funny stuff, you know, it's just funny in the moment. It's funny in the context. But, yeah, the Stoics would be journal keepers. And, you know, it's a practice I've always done because you don't know when, like you don't know in the future what part of your past you're going to need for a certain book. Like it might be, like I want to do a book in the next few years set in 2018. And I've got so many diaries from that year. Not for any particular reason. I've just picked it as a year. I have a day diary. I have journals. I have notes. I have the columns from that year. So if I decide to do a project, I'll have a huge reference sort of library to hand. And, it's exciting. You go through something terrible, you forget the texture of it and the detail. And so you go through another hard time and the pain feels fresh. And so I think, you know, being able to sort of reference your past self, you know, for some people that's a nightmare. Like what a nightmare to go back to, you know, an incident in your youth. But for me, I think it's, you know, you can learn from the past.
I like that. One of the things that struck me in looking at your articles, also having read your books, is endings. You do endings so well. I'm curious if endings are a thing that you think about, and is there something that you look for in an ending?
So I find endings the hardest and I struggle with them. I often used to submit stories without an ending. And then, you know, there'd be real pressure to get an ending. And so it would always be the nasty last bit. And then with that pressure, there would be something good, you know, hopefully. I also liked with the columns, with an ending, you know, it's not just something that happened to me. It often a lot of the things that I'm interested in writing about are universal. So particularly writing during the pandemic, doing those pandemic columns, I would write, say, 1 week I'd be in a rage about something, you know, I'd just be storming around and I'd be writing about my own experience. But then the last paragraph is always saying, well, this is the point in the pandemic where we've had enough, you know, we've got to get back to our old lives or something. And that's the connection to the reader is that final, you know, those final parts. So, yeah.
Mm.
Also, the endings might be good because I'm pleased to finish.
The endings might be good because, can sympathise with that.
It's over.
You wrote Wellmania, the book on which the TV series has now been based. Bearing in mind that Wellmania is a lot about extremity, was there a habit or health thing that you did then that has stuck with you as worth pursuing?
Well, it definitely wasn't the extreme fast, the Chinese herbal medicine fast where I didn't eat for 2 weeks. I have not stuck with that. I meditate twice a day. So that's the kind of thing.
Right.
It's good. It's a good thing to do. It's portable. It's free. It's, I work in Parliament House. So this morning I meditated in the meditation room in Parliament, which is a really unusual place to meditate. But you can, you know, as long as you have a little space, you can do it anywhere. And it does calm you down.
Are there other people meditating at the same time? Like, is it a popular room?
No, it looks a bit like, it's kind of like three confessional booths. So you can't see, you can see people's shoes. But yeah, you're not, you know, you're kind of hidden.
Yeah, that's cool. To check that out. When, that's probably not for visitors though, is it?
I don't think so, no. I'll sign you in.
Bridget, in relation to your career, how do you think about what you want or what you want to achieve? Do you set goals? Do you visualize, manifest, roll from one thing to the next organically? What does that look like?
I have an idea of what I want to do. Often it's quite long term. So like with the columns, I wanted to do a column probably 20 years before I got the column. So with political speech writing, I wanted to do it a long time ago. So there are things that, you know, Labor hasn't been in power for a long time. I went for jobs in the Gillard, Rudd governments and didn't get them. And, you know, so it was, what's that, 15 years? 20 years for the columns, a long time for books, a long time for television. So, yeah, I would say to anyone wanting to be, you know, have these huge careers under 30, it's that didn't happen for me. Like I kind of struggled along for many years with ambitions that just took a very long time to manifest.
We love talking about failures, maybe related to the answer that you just gave. Do you have a favourite failure?
So I spent 7 years writing a novel called Wild Things, and that was published by HarperCollins. So that was incredibly exciting. But it just didn't sell well. Like it just didn't make the impact that I wanted it to make. And I think the advance was like $3,000 or something. Like it was a small advance. And it was really tempting when that book came out. It just felt like it just came out and then it left very quietly. And that was sort of devastating because, you know, the publisher moves on. I mean, I love that publisher. It's Catherine Milne. So, you know, it's not like the relationship with the publisher ends, but they then go on and publish. They've got books the next month coming out. And it was that realization, and I'm sure other guests have said very similar things. It's that realization of sometimes you only have a month. You know, you have 1 month, you have your big launch, it's exciting, you see the book everywhere, and then you go back to readings or you go back to Glade Books and it's gone. And it's gone forever. It's not coming back. And that's a sort of grief. And looking at that now with a stoic lens, I would say I had so much pleasure writing that book. You know, it was so pleasurable on a sentence level. It was just, you know, I was living in London, I was writing in pubs. It was part of my experience of that city. I joined a writing group. It didn't do well, but it was an enriching experience. So I've kind of reframed that now. But at the time it was hard because of the huge amount of sunk costs, you know, the 7 years. I was like, maybe I should have been doing another project. So is that a failure? I don't know.
Well, that's a good question, actually. I like that reframe though. Like I do think in this creative realm, you could do a spin-off book just about stoicism for creatives. I think they're really, it is a very useful thing. We are now towards the end of the interview. I just have a handful of quick fire questions. Some of them might be easier answer than others. You can pass on any question. What's the best thing you've bought for under $100 in the last 6 months?
I just bought this evening $91 worth of petrol. And that's the best thing I've bought because I'm a new driver and it's exciting to buy petrol. It means I can get around. So, it's still novel to, go to a servo, get the thing off the Bowser. In fact, I had to ask someone when I first got petrol like a year or so ago, how does it work?
So, yeah, really? Did your parents not make you do that for them? God,
I don't know. Oh, a long time ago, maybe, but no.
Oh, that's hilarious. What does the first 60 minutes of your day look like?
It's pretty gross. I have to be at work at 7:45, so in a sitting week. So I wake up, I put on RN, I check all my messages that are coming through. I make sure I have like lunch packed, laptops, chargers. Make a coffee, put it in a keep cup, quick shower, dressed, in a car, gone.
Wow. Does that feel like a big contrast to times of life that you have written outside of the political space?
I used to write in bed. So I'd wake up and just get a coffee and go back to bed and then maybe get up around 11 a.m. and stretch my legs, Yeah, it's horrific, the contrast, but yeah, it's it would have been bad for me had I spent my entire like career in bed. Would have got rickets.
That's true too. Well, you can always go back. You can circle back.
Can always go back to bed.
That's right. Final question. Do you have a favorite quote or mantra?
Yeah, I do. It's this Marcus Aurelius quote. And you know, it's kind of, I think it's quite prominent in my book. Accept the things to which fate binds you and love the people with whom fate brings you together, but do so with all your heart. Isn't that beautiful?
I remember that one from the book now that you've read it out. That is beautiful.
It's kind of about saying, well, these are the people in your life, you know, like enjoy them, love them, love them fully, you know, don't love them a little bit. Fate has brought you with the people that are in your life and who are alive at this point in history. So love them. So, yeah.
Great. That's such a lovely note to finish on.
You can find show notes for this episode of The Next Step at katherinecollette.com. You can get in touch via that website or via Instagram at katherinecolletteWriter.